Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rucca. On today's program, we're going to hear a condensed version of Notes from the Riverkeepers, an information-packed piece of performance art presented at the Columbian Theater 2 weeks ago as part of an Oregon and Washington tour. Artist Holcomb Waller takes us from the discovery of Bakken crude oil in the Dakotas back through the eons to the Ice Age mega floods and the shaping of the Columbia River Gorge. Then forward again as he follows the money through development of the railroads and the shipment of crude oil by rail. He ends with a vivid moment-by-moment description of the train derailment and oil spill at Mosier, Oregon. It's a history lesson, an expose, and a cry for the environment. Let's listen in.
It's 1951, and you're standing in a vast open theater of broad, dusty plains. It's your family farm in Tioga, North Dakota. And your name is Henry, Henry Bakken. And this land is your land. Henry just struck oil here, below Antelope Field. Turns out that easy oil will run out soon enough, but when your drill is reaching down for that easy-to-get oil, you hit this darker, moodier layer of your timeless spirit. You know, your narrative point of view. Yeah, that's right, your drill hits this rocky, cracked, crumbly shale soaked like a rock-solid sponge, full of millions of gallons of oil, 10,000 feet deep. So, look around. Look around this theater of these dusty plains. It sits on top of the sedimentary basin of your ancient ocean. From northwest North Dakota to northeast Montana. From southeast Saskatchewan to the southwest corner of Manitoba. There's 3 or 4 billion gallons of easy-to-get oil here in this vast theater, but there's 20, 30, or maybe 40 billion gallons of oil that can't be recovered with 1951 technology. No. It won't be until the 21st century that unconventional drilling technology will bring countless players into this theater of the Bakken Shale Formation. So many players will come, but with just one play. One energy play. So, we'll name the whole theater for that play. We're gonna call it the Bakken Shale Play. Meanwhile, it's the end of the last ice age. 15,000 years ago, a glacial ice sheet descends over what will one day be the entire country of Canada. The face of your timeless spirit is the entire North American continent, the West Coast. It's your cheek, and it's your good side, you know. This ice sheet is sweeping across your face like sexy bangs, but one curly little piece is dangling down the Idaho Panhandle, and it blocks the Clark Fork River. Slowly, this block forms a glacial dam that grows as the river backs up over 200 miles east into the Montana valleys, creating Great Glacial Lake Missoula, a lake that reaches 2,000 feet of depth and contains over 500 cubic miles of water. But, you're starting to get this little ice cream headache because as this ice dam grows thousands of feet high, the water at the base of it becomes so intensely heavy with pressure that it actually lowers the freezing point of water itself. And the lake starts to push into the melting cracks and fissures at the base of the dam until one day the dam ruptures from the bottom up all at once, and 10 times the flow of all the rivers of the world comes rushing at 80 miles per hour across the plains, into the Cascades, and through the Columbia River Gorge. And within minutes, the water is reaching 1,000 feet of depth at the Dalles, 540 feet at Troutdale, 400 feet over Portland and across the Willamette Valley all the way down to Eugene. The power of this water displaces and deposits over 50 cubic miles of earth and stone throughout the valleys and hundreds of miles out here into the ocean, right out here. And this all happens in about 48 hours. But even as the valleys are draining, that ice dam is reforming. And it's filling Lake Missoula, and in about 50 years, one day the depths and pressure soften that ice down at the bottom, and the dam ruptures again from the bottom up, and the power of this water shakes the earth for thousands of miles. The power of this water strips away thick soils, cutting deep canyons into the underlying bedrock. The power of this water redistributes soil into entirely new landforms, sandbars 400 feet high. And the geological pendulum swings. The glacial dam reforms and then ruptures. It reforms and then ruptures. Every 50 years, for 2,000 years, and the final Missoula flood baptizes the landscape in cataclysm just as the first signs of native people reveal themselves in their ceramic shards and tools, unburied from the shorelines of the only navigable path, from the Columbia River Plateau down to the ocean below, in a gradient so steep and broad that the water flowing down it will have a greater force of potential energy than along any other riverway on the entire continent. Whoa! The Missoula floods, this broad, fresh, fast-moving water will seduce vast spawning grounds of Andronymous fish returning from salt to fresh water to perpetuate your timeless spirit. After 2,000 years of floods, the gorge will form sacred meeting points and bustling trading centers for First Nations people and a gateway bringing their fishing trade deep into the North American interior and snaking along this cataclysm-formed gateway through the Cascades and east towards Missoula, Montana, we see steamboats. And then we see barges, we'll see canals, and then locks, and eventually a dam impounding reservoir at every single U.S. mile of its course, disrupting ecosystems, displacing native fishing grounds, and generating close to half of all the hydroelectric power in the United States. And burrowing into this majestic gorge, we see colonization, we see oppression, we see industrialization and settlement and resettlement, and eventually along each shoreline, a railroad line, snaking up the Cascades, out towards Missoula, and across your timeless spirit, into North Dakota, into North Dakota, across your timeless spirit, into North Dakota. Migration into the American interior as the railroad companies rack up huge sums of profits for selling off all that extra land. And they become some of the most powerful businesses entwined with the federal government, whose exclusive regulatory power over them overrides all state and municipal governance in favor of a tightly enmeshed and focused nexus of federal influence dedicated to externalizing the costs and risks of moving cargo onto a nationwide system of common carriers. Meanwhile, here in Oregon, local legends Harrison Olmsted and Joseph Ruckles start dabbling in portage railroad lines, and in 1855, along the southern side of the Columbia River Gorge, they build a little portage thing, and in 1862, John C. Ainsworth ships up a bunch of rails and a small locomotive called the Oregon Pony, and they arrive from California, and within months, workers have transformed Ruckle and Olmsted's rickety little system into the gorge's first standard gauge railroad line, a 5-mile route along the southern side of the river from the head of the Cascade Rapids down to Tanner Creek. Then, in 1905, on the northern side of the gorge, the Great Northern and Northern Pacific Railroad Companies launched the Spokane-Portland-Seattle Railway, forming a northern transcontinental line through Spokane, and they do this to try and capture some of the Pacific Northwest logging trade from their competitors who are already sending it up and down the southern side. Let's build this up, guys. I need a little something to sing about all this Pacific Northwest timber. Let's build this up, spreading to four corners of the biggest economic power engine of the 20th century. Cause we're gonna build it up, we're gonna build it up, we're gonna build, 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 build the United States of America. Build the United States of America with all that timber, with all that logging, and with these train companies just bringing it everywhere. To present day, railroad companies would form and merge and monopolize and break up in endless permutations through wars, booms, and busts. But by the 1990s, all of these threads of this story weave together into two main braids, a duopoly. Warren Buffett's private holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, based in Fort Worth, Texas, would acquire, restructure, and merge the remnants of over 390 railroad lines, including the gorge's northern shoreline, within a holding company first called Burlington Northern Santa Fe, and later, and to present day, abbreviated as BNSF. and Union Pacific, a publicly traded company based in Omaha, Nebraska, retains the gorgeous southern side and the one right, you know, near here, allowing each of these duopolies, Union Pacific and BNSF, to leverage the cataclysmic geological power of that water-carved gateway through the Cascades, delivering cargo from deep in the American interior to the seaports of the Columbia River right here and north to the shipping yards of the Puget Sound. There's so much mystery unfurling, you know, like Neil Young said in that song from Philadelphia. For example, here's a mystery. I watched a YouTube video of the mayor of Mosier speaking just a couple days after the train derailed there in June of last year, and someone asked a simple question. They said, "Whose oil is this, Mrs. Mayor?" And interestingly, she said, "I don't know. None of us know. No one will tell us. We have no way of knowing when these trains come. We don't know anything. We'll look into it." And I thought, huh. And so I Googled it, and indeed, there was no coverage of whose oil this was. No one on KOIN, no one on OPB, no one at the Oregonian. Neither of the weeklies. Nobody mentioned anything about who was profiting from this oil transportation, since the official word was that Union Pacific, as the common carrier that answers exclusively to the federal government, was entirely responsible for this cargo and for the cleanup. That's a crazy, crazy world, because responsibility isn't really how we think of it in our life. No, responsibility here is the result of legal precedent, corporate structures, contracts, regulation, insurance, and the like. These things convert the sort of accountability we common folk think of when it comes to responsible behavior into financial risk management. So in the energy sector, rather than talk in common language, they talk about enforcing standards within the supply chain, which in many ways is a way of saying we dump risk on other people to ask them to manage very, very well for us. And in this world, government regulation is not anti-business, no. It's a great way to let the energy sector fulfill their obligations to safety standards that their lobbyists make sure are set at a very, very low bar. So they can wipe their hands clean when something goes wrong. So when the oil spills or explodes in transport with Union Pacific, it's not the energy companies who are profiting from that oil who are responsible, no. The energy companies in Washington ensure that Union Pacific can take extreme risks with the public safety and environmental safety, with volatile cargo like crude oil, with a minimum of safety standards. And Union Pacific reciprocates this by offering them impunity when things go wrong, and it's a great deal for everyone. Mum's the word. Union Pacific won't tell you whose oil this was. But I'll tell you, if you want to know. Yeah, that oil was heading on this very track, well, that very track out there, to U.S. Oil and Refinery up on Commencement Bay in Tacoma, Washington. And U.S. Oil and Refinery on Commencement Bay was purchased in 2013 by a shell company called Trailstone LLC. And Trailstone LLC was created in 2012, a year earlier, and by a private equity company called Riverstone LLC. So it's like rivers and trails, I mean, it's great. And Riverstone LLC was founded 10 years ago, around the time of the fracking oil boom, by two ex-Goldman Sachs billionaires breaking out of their roles in financial risk management in energy investments for Goldman Sachs so that they could personally get in on the action, particularly the action of the fracking oil boom of the Bakken Shale play, but in other places as well. And to make all this money, what they do is these private equity assets, such as Riverstone LLC, Trailstone LLC, U.S. Oil and Refinery on Commencement Bay, they buy up energy assets, and then they play matchmaker in chess with their executives as the chess pieces, and they contract risk where it sits best and reduce it by bearing it somewhere strategically. And then these two ex-Goldman Sachs guys, you know, they own the private equity companies, Riverstone LLC, Trailstone LLC, and they owned all of that oil that derailed and spilled and exploded in Mosier. But the responsibility for that oil in transit belonged to Union Pacific, whose rail car standards can explode at 8 miles per hour with a possible radius of like a 1 mile blast zone. And Union Pacific's railroad tracks are like from the Civil War era, and they're in very bad disrepair, despite everything they say to the contrary. So while it's incredibly unsafe to transport this oil by trains, it's very cheap and very risk-free for Riverstone LLC to make money doing it, thanks to the federal railroad system. And to broaden this picture here, Riverstone LLC, through its subsidiary, Charleston LLC, partnered with a truck driver in North Dakota who used to just transload the fracking oil into these holding tanks at these big shipping terminals they would rent. They partnered with this guy to build a terminal of their own out there in North Dakota. If you want something to do on your computers tonight when you get home, just go to Google Maps and visually follow the railroad line out the gorge into North Dakota, and you will see at every single mile, huge 2-mile loops with these big sheds over pumps and then the holding tanks sort of sitting there waiting full of crude oil. This is the kind of terminal Riverstone, aka Trailstone, was partnering to build with this truck driver. Truck drivers come and they load up these holding tanks from the fracking oil fields, and from there that terminal can fill a 2-mile long trains every day, and then they can roll it out via Union Pacific or BNSF on the North Shore on all these unsafe old tracks and be fully in compliance with all current federal safety standards and completely beyond the purview of local, state, or municipal government. These private equity players can do this without any financial responsibility for accidents, for spills, for fires, nothing. And then in Commencement Bay in Tacoma, they can load it onto ships the size of the Exxon Valdez at their wholly owned subsidiary, U.S. Oil and Refinery. And this vertically integrated supply chain is entirely owned by a single private equity company that is primarily owned by two ex-Goldman Sachs money men. And in case that Tesoro plant gets built in Vancouver, Washington, they'll be shipping it there, putting it on the Exxon Valdez ships, which will then be sort of navigating the moving sandbars out here. So it's not a mystery who owns this oil. And get this, the returns on all this are so huge that your retirement funds are jumping into these private equity investments to the tune of $35 billion alone in the Riverstone LLC private equity. The oil business is as dirty as it sounds. New York State recently settled with two of the founders of Riverstone LLC for bribing their public employee pension fund manager into dumping $500,000 of their public pension fund money into the very fund that bought U.S. Oil and Refinery up at Commencement Bay, the very fund that is financing the construction of the North Dakota train loading terminal, and the very fund that owned all the Bakken crude oil carried by Union Pacific train number 5544 that derailed and spilled and exploded in Mosier, Oregon last year on Friday, June 3rd. So now you know. A North Dakota evening, Wednesday, 1st of June. A big loop of track in Newtown, North Dakota, new since the fracking boom. Ooh, this 2-mile loop encircles big holding tanks full of crude. Dakota Gold, Bakken crude, transloaded there by truckers with a Dakota can-do attitude. Oh, a diesel locomotive, UP5544. At the head of 96 unpressurized tank cars, owned or rented by U.S. Oil. U.S. Oil and Refinery up in Commencement Bay. And those shed-covered pumps filled that train up in just over 12 hours. And into the next morning when our girl pulls out into this gentle mix of Dakota sun and shower. The spikes, the ties are worn, but these old rails aren't gonna fail her now. No, you've never seen 115,000 tons of anything float like the bird that's rolling past you now. And where other trains derail, this one's your winning horse, yeah. She's gonna make it all the way, yeah. 80,000 barrels to Commencement Bay. To be refined, offloaded, shipped, and on its way into the big, big blue up and away. atmosphere away. Choke point on those raised tracks through downtown. Ooh, she's rolling on through the night at a regulated 50 in the open and 40 through the stations. She's cruising south through Yakima Indian and Nez Perce Reservation. That horseshoe hard at Pasco, through flower fields and sarsaparilla. Oh, it's 85 degrees at 10 a.m. coming round through Umatilla. She's edging along the Columbia River wetlands, sometimes a mile or more from any roadways. Oh, all that weight is shaving down the edges of the tracks, so far out of reach along the waterways. Oh, those spikes, those ties are worn, but these old rails aren't gonna fail her now. No, no. You've never seen 80,000 barrels of anything float like the golden eagle that's rolling past you now. Oh, no, no. And where other trails derail, this one is your Trojan horse, yes. She's gonna make it all away. 4 million barrels of Dakota gold up to Commencement Bay. And on its way up into the big, big blue, up and away. Up into the big picture, blue atmosphere away. Past the storefronts of the Downs, she's rolling through downtown. That marine supply store and Baldwin Saloon. Oh, those grassy, grassy festival grounds. Past the burial vaults, at rest on that little island, Memaloose Island. Whoa. She's banking hard towards the Mosier Plateau in that big curve there. That big curve there are goes around all that farmland. Oh, she's snaking along the interstate, 100 feet from those Mosier Creek apartments. They see the trains go by all the time. She's cruising past the Mosier schoolhouse and the school fields beneath the old 30 overpass. It's 90 degrees and windless at 12:15 on Friday, June 3rd, at mile marker 68.5. The engineers felt a sudden tug jolting them backwards as the 18th car passed over a single rusting bolt connecting the rail to its rail tie. That a visual track inspection just days before could never have possibly detected. And the weight of that oil-filled train pushed into the outer rail of that invisibly gentle curve, you'd swear it was a straightaway. And as this single rusting bolt fails, the track widens just enough for the front left wheel of that 18th car to fall directly onto the ties. immediately, a Civil War-era pneumatic braking system deploys a stop signal from the front locomotive towards the rear, car by car, via pressurized air hoses. But as car 18's wheels thump along the rail ties, boom, 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 they spread the tracks apart, literally unzipping them. As the nose of the car tilts down and angles off the track, the 17 cars in front break free, and three-quarter miles of now headless, oil-filled trains' brakes fail to get that pneumatic braking signal through those hoses, and they start pushing into car 18 as it slides dozens of feet off the track. And the cars behind it start colliding and derailing and accordioning, like into a tight pile of hot, volatile Bakken oil bombs lined up like sausages on a grill in the hot summer sun. The first four of these cars rupture, spark, ignite, and then explode into fireballs and black plumes of smoke. 16 cars will derail before the beheaded tail of UP5544 stops rolling. 42,000 gallons of oil are released, 18,000 into the soil, 13,000 into the Mosier sewer treatment plant through a manhole that was shaved off by all the sliding cars, and the remaining 16,000 gallons burn or vaporize in fire and explosions. Mosier's fire department's mostly volunteer crew respond first, calling in backup from Hood River, the Dalles, anywhere. Using water and only water, they cool the tanks adjacent to the burning oil to keep those tanks next to them from exploding from the heat and the pressure. And 160 kids from Mosier School, about 400 feet away, and all the citizens within a quarter mile are evacuated. And within hours, Union Pacific's emergency response team will be coordinating all government agency responses. And they'll be orchestrating a robust, highly resourced PR and legal response in the same time frame. After burning off for 14 hours, chemical foam will finally extinguish the last of the flames, just as a Union Pacific planes trailer is arriving to exchange payouts for signed waivers early the next morning. People are demanding explanations, they're demanding change, they're demanding a halt to the expansions that are being proposed again and again for the railroad lines right next to the 1 mile of shoreline next to Mosier. They're demanding a halt to the expansion of the Tesoro crude oil shipping terminal, the construction of it, I should say, in the port of Vancouver here. They're demanding a halt now to the newly proposed expansion of U.S. oil and refinery up there in Commencement Bay in Tacoma. But the mastery of Union Pacific's public relations efforts keep all the focus on adherence to federal regulations, improving safety standards, new rail car regulations, ongoing infrastructure improvement efforts. And in all the coverage, in all the papers, and all the TV segments, no one ever mentions or has ever heard of Riverstone LLC, or its holding company, Trailstone LLC, or either of the two founding bankers at the head of these financial shell games. And all of their executives comprised almost entirely of ex-Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank investment bankers. These are the central players and profiteers for the entire industry of crude oil transportation through the gorge. But these men remain effectively ghosts, unnamed, unquestioned by the media, shielded by the railroad companies, quietly living their lives as philanthropic juggernauts known for their particular interest and generosity in supporting the arts and ecological preservation in their communities of Westman, Montana, Austin, Texas, and New York City.
Notes from the Riverkeepers by artist Holcomb Waller, focusing on the issues facing Columbia Riverkeeper as stewards of the Columbia River. This is The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rucka. Thanks for listening.